Welcome to another episode of the Brothers F Bookcast. This time we are joined for the first time ever and the first ever Brothers F non-brother guest, Mr. John Foley. You want to say hi, John?
Very honored to be here. Thank you, Francisco.
Well, I don't know if you should feel honored, but I'm pleased to have you here. You're a friend from college, and you're a great dude. You're a good dude. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself? Like, what's your deal? I know what your deal is, but can you tell the listeners what your deal is?
Sure. So I am a full-time practicing artist and illustrator. I was trained in fine art, particularly painting, under a master painter, Paul Ingbritsen, for the past, 3 years out of my formal training, but had about 3 to 3.5 years actually of training under him. And that was after not getting a whole lot of training in a mainstream college major at Notre Dame. I'm thankful for many of the things I had through Notre Dame, but the fine art training, I would say I got most entirely from my classical teacher. So that's a brief synopsis.
Sure. I mean, I saw some of the stuff you did while you were at Notre Dame, and I thought it was pretty good. But you know, what do I know?
I'm
kind of a Philistine.
Well, I'm glad you liked it. I don't have too much against it, but you know, I think it got better since then. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah. I noticed how I complimented and insulted you at the same time. I said I liked it, but I also have bad taste.
No, it's funny. It's funny. Taste is one of those funny things when it's around art. And I love the scene actually at the beginning of the story, not to jump into things too fast, where they talk about the members of the club and the port with the cigar versus the guy who just was like, just like beer in a pipe.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the story a little bit. It's a story in part about art, which I think is why you picked it. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a story by Dorothy Sayers. And I think you know a little bit more about her than I do. So can you introduce her to the audience? Because one of my brothers just absolutely loves her, and if this story's any indication, she's a brilliant writer. So I'd like to hear a little more about what her deal is.
Oh, I'm glad. Yeah, she's really awesome. So she was an academic as well as a very good popular writer, a combination which, you know, with the exception of J.R.R. Tolkien, I have a hard time coming up with a lot more examples of that. But I feel like she's perhaps of a similar caliber in the sense that she brings a lot of knowledge and a lot of fun stuff from her academic world into her fiction writing, which I think is just brilliant stuff. Just so she does the Lord Peter Wimsey series, which this short story actually features Lord Peter Wimsey, who's, you know, sort of this hero of this other mystery series. But she's done a lot of work, including some great essays. The Lost Tools of Learning is one of her most famous essays. It's sort of big in the classical education community, as well as one of my favorite books of hers called The Mind of the Maker, which I find to be one of the best explorations in aesthetics that I've ever read. So maybe that's, I think she was at Oxford too. It wasn't, you know, that she was just any academic. She was pretty sharp.
What was her specialty?
That's a great question. I think it was some sort of classics or literature. I don't know. I do know that she did a translation of Dante's Inferno, which is awesome and has an amazing commentary. So I imagine probably literature. I don't know. Honestly, I don't.
All right, fair enough. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. You do know a good deal more about her than I do. But let's talk about this story in particular. So, you suggested Dorothy Sayers, and I asked you to pick a story. and you picked The Abominable History of the Man with the Copper Fingers. And when you read that title, the first question is, what the hell is going on? what is going on here?
Absolutely.
So why this?
Yeah, I found it an awesome example of, you know, just a fun mystery, but also just packed with a whole lot of other images dealing with art and dealing with, you know, just I don't know, maybe life in general. But so this particular story is sort of what I would articulate as maybe an anti-Pygmalion story, if that makes sense.
Ooh, I didn't think about that at all, but I want to hear what you have to say.
So Pygmalion is this myth basically the myth of an ancient Greek sculptor who loves his work so much and crafts it so much. And so basically his work being this beautiful image of a lady. You know, the Greeks were into these, you know, classical nude sculptures. And so he just pours his heart into this sculpture until it comes alive. Like the gods grant that, you know, basically his desire for this beautiful woman to be fulfilled by her coming alive and basically, you know, them going off and getting married or whatever, you know, riding off in the sunset.
Yeah. You know, so when you said Pygmalion, I thought of My Fair Lady.
Yeah.
There's the Greek myth. But I was like, how is he going to tie this to My Fair Lady? But of course, the Greek myth makes sense. And I see what you're driving at there with it being an anti-Pygmalion story. And I guess, spoiler alert, we should probably explain how it's an anti-Pygmalion story.
Do you want to go ahead and give us the synopsis?
Sure. So the gist of the story is that there's this extremely... first, the story's set up in this club. It's a bunch of very sort of posh British guys talking in this club, and they're telling stories from their life. And the first narrator is this actor who's just an incredibly handsome guy. And he's...
A lot like you, Francisco.
A lot. Indeed. Relatable content. and, you know, he goes... what happens is that he gets involved with this artist, Loder, and this woman, Maria. And Maria and Loder are having relationship problems, and the relationship ends up not working out, to put it mildly. And Loder blames Mr. Hansen, whose name is escaping me. What's the dude's name?
What is it? It starts with a V, yeah. Varden? That sounds right. Yep.
So what happens to Varden is that he's planning to take a trip, abroad. And before he takes that trip, Loder, the artist, invites him to spend some time with him in his house. So he goes there, and while he's staying with Loder, the hero of the story, the detective, I guess, Peter Whimsy, comes in and tells him that, he needs to leave, because Loder's going to kill him. Now, the story starts with Varden, or, you know, Mr. Handsome telling the story. And as he's telling the story, Peter Whimsy comes in and says and tells them, you know, he was actually the person who warned V away from the house. Peter Whimsy kind of jumps in the middle of Varden's story. And he says, yeah, like, I was the dude. I'm the guy who came in and warned you. And so he tells the story of how he figured out what was going on. So there's the statue of the man's ex-lover, Maria, in the house. And he looked at it and he noticed this tiny little detail about the way her toes were sculpted. And based on that, he began to suspect that this was actually not just a statue, but a tomb that...
This ties in with the Greek idea of idealizing figures in their sculpture. They're always striving not just for realism, but for this idealized form that corrected a lot of the imperfections that they saw in human individuals to try and get at this overarching truth and beauty that was in the human form. So just my art note to interject there.
Yeah. I mean the one thing that according to Loader that was wrong with her body was that the toe next to her big toe was either too long or too short. I can't remember which, but he generally when he depicted her, he fixed it. But Peter Whimsy noticed that in this statue that so-called flaw was not fixed. And that kind of tipped him off that something might be amiss. So he does a little investigating and he finds that Loader's got a secret chamber where he's forging a passport and he's got poison and everything looks really suspicious. And he comes to the conclusion that he's planning to kill Vardin the day before he leaves for Australia, forge his passport, have somebody else go on the trip. And that way get away with a perfect murder because no one will think he's dead if he's abroad. And, he figures it out and he goes to confront Loader in his secret chamber that, you know, there's a secret passageway. It's all very, it's very moneyed, British, you know what it reminds me a lot of? Have you ever read P.G. Woodhouse?
Oh, yes. Love P.G. Woodhouse. Yes. Well, this is, yep.
Yeah, very similar, I guess Whimsy isn't dumb, but it seems like there's a lot of English gentlemen with more brains and leisure than money. more leisure and money than brains, excuse me.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's sort of like P.G. Woodhouse meets something like Sherlock Holmes and something like Jane Austen, but not probably quite as good on the romance side.
Well, she's like Agatha Christie, right?
Sort of. I mean, I tell people like it's more than Agatha Christie for my buck. Agatha Christie has the murder mystery, but this is like, just so much fun to read, like sentence to sentence writing, as well as, like the comedy and the romance too thrown in. So I feel like I don't have much patience for regular mysteries, but I love Dorothy Sayers.
Okay, that's interesting. So not a mystery fan in general, but a fan of Dorothy Sayers.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Oh, I guess we should explain the title, which we have yet to have explained. So what happens is, and this doesn't make any sense to me at all, but I'm just going to suspend my disbelief. But when Loader, the villain, dies, he falls into this vat of poison. I think it's arsenic. And something with the graphite on his hands reacts with the arsenic and his hands becomes covered in copper. And Peter Whimsy manages to escape without anyone realizing that he was involved in any way with Loader's death, which he seems to think might have been a crime, but doesn't really sound like a crime to me, though I'm not not a criminal law expert, but...
No advice given here, right?
No legal advice. But his hand becomes encrusted in copper and they can't fix it, so he's buried that way. So, I mean, but even I can tell that's probably some kind of symbol.
Interesting. Yeah. Huh. What do you think it symbolizes, Francisco?
Well, I don't know exactly, but I know something's going on here. Like, so then he becomes something of a statue himself.
How so?
Well, he gets covered in copper.
That's right. Yeah. I wonder if there's other like sort of pre-foreshadowings or something like that of how he almost becomes almost a caricature of himself, the way that Vardin talks about him. He talks about how he has this trick of repeating himself that he finds. And this, like, there's some, like, you know, something about him seemed more real. Like the description of this guy Loader seemed fascinating from that respect to me this time through.
So let me ask you this. What do you think about the story as an artist? Is there something there that appeals to you? Because you've already said that you're an admirer of Dorothy Sayers' theory of aesthetics. So do you see any of that in the story?
Absolutely. Like I definitely am reading it, sort of thinking about, okay, the process of how an artist makes art and one of the big things that Dorothy Sayers talks about in her theory of aesthetics is basically an artist has to go from idea first, and then go into the craft, like understanding a craft, like, you know, whether it's sculpture, painting, writing, making a play, and take that idea and transform it into something that's intelligible for the craft, and that is conforming to the rules of it. And basically it is vitally transformed, even though the idea stays the same in a certain sense. And then final step that she describes is sort of the audience's acceptance of it and how that actually can change the world. And she actually takes these three ideas and she describes them as the father, son, and spirit almost of art. So, like, you know, it's a great analogy in her book, and I'm gonna do a very petty, horrible job of relaying it here, I'm sure. But basically, the father is the concept in art. You know, there's this grand idea, like in the beginning, this disembodied thing that comes to the artist's head, and that in a certain sense is almost fully formed even before an artist sets his hand to doing anything, to making the sculpture, to making the painting, to making the book. But then that's when sort of this crafting happens, this idea of, you know, you're an expert painter, so you take this idea and you enflesh it in paint. You know, or you make it into this dynamic story, or and then there's the final step of, okay, what does this, you know, actual embodied sculpture, story, painting do to the world? What is it, you know, like sort of like this Pentecost of this idea actually being released, you know, so that now John Folley made this amazing painting. Now Francisco reacts to it. Now my, you know, brothers and sisters, you know, like the art critics down the street, they write about it in the Globe, whatever, you know, but it makes changes in the rest of the world. So, anyway, this is a long-winded way to say there's sort of this, also this backward thing that's happening when Loder makes Maria into a sculpture. It's basically taking, instead of going from an idea to, you know, the craft to the Pentecost type of thing. It's sort of like this reverse thing. There's like this emotional disaster that's happening of him, like, you know, basically despising and at the same time wanting Maria, you know. So there's this emotional, like, anti-Pentecost. And then there's this, you know, basically the craft, you know, anti-craft, you know. It's basically, instead of doing crafting, he's taking the skipping the step and just basically making a mold of this person. And, you know, in effect, like, it's sort of this anti-idea. It's, you know, there's no idea behind it except for just stealing this person's body and erasing essentially the idea of their soul. So it's sort of funny to me. It's almost like reversing each part of that theory, you know. It's my reading into it at this point.
Yeah, that's really deep. is it too on the nose to say that he's objectifying her?
I think that's a pretty solid observation. Yeah, I think that's quite true.
Literally and figuratively.
yeah. No, absolutely. And just changing what's spirit, what's true. Yeah. Yeah, taking her down.
So that was a somewhat abstract and philosophical description of the process of making art. Is that true to your experience?
Yeah, it's fascinating to me, like how true it is, honestly. Like, you know, this idea of, you know, yeah, sometimes you just get this idea, this inspiration. You know, sometimes it, you know, it's just all there all at once. Sometimes you spin it around in your head. But yeah, like this idea-centered aspect. And then, you know, then there's this sort of like the next phase. Like, it's definitely very much these phases. One of the things that I think is fascinating, I'm probably going too tangential here, but she sort of talks about artists, you know, sort of leaning towards one phase or another of these things. And I think it's funny because I think probably in my work, I tend towards more like this craft orientation, you know, almost like, you know, there's, she says, like, there's every artist sort of leans towards one aspect and sort of usually has deficiencies in one or two of the others. But it's a fun thing. Anyway, it probably doesn't mean too much to anyone, but, no, at least, you know, in the abstract here.
to me, but I mean, I think it might be helpful if you could give like an example of something that you've created. I mean, you're primarily a painter. Am I wrong about that?
No, that's right. That's right. So oil painting primarily.
So can you give an example of a painting of yours that, and just talk us through that process and maybe slightly less philosophical terms?
Sure. Yeah. So that's a great question. So yeah, one painting that occurs. So, So sometimes I do book illustrations. So we talked earlier about, before this podcast started, Mr. Meehan's Mildly Amusing Mythical Mammals. And this is definitely
fast.
Sorry.
Say that five times fast.
Yeah. No, don't try. Don't try. You'll knock yourself out. But yeah, so, that's one that I definitely looked at, you know, and, you know, my buddy and I came up with this scheme to do all these paintings to illustrate a bunch of his poems. And this was a type of painting that I definitely was like, yeah, there's these great ideas. And then trying to get those, you know, basically onto canvas, was my job. But I would say this is one instance where I found this was a very idea driven piece of art. And the craft was sort of following the idea and almost less important than the idea itself. And then the spirit hopefully also is going to be something that, like, yeah, it's meant to be shared. It's meant, you know, it's basically a children's book, but it's, you know, it's, we like to call it the Pixar of children's books. We want it to be something that appeals to adults and the children as they're reading it, as they're getting these great ideas, also enjoying the craft of these images. But in a certain sense, the craft is, you know, less the central part of this work, as opposed to, for instance, when I do a still life, you know, a still life painting, the idea is there. Like the idea usually is a lot simpler than a still life in the sense that it's not very much dealing with the arts or humanities or anything like that. So much it's, you know, it's like making a melody. It's like, okay, how do these things fit together, these objects, in terms of color, in terms of size, in terms of shape, in terms of arrangement, almost to make a beautiful piece of visual music. So when I make a still life, I imagine myself almost as like a composer who's making a piece of music that's, yeah, it's just abstract notes and things like that. But you have to put the notes in right relationship to each other. You have to make the chords feel right, the timing feel right. The same type of thing happens when you do a good still life. You have to try and make the colors, the shapes, all of those things. You want to make harmonies out of them. You don't want to just make realism for realism's sake. This is something I thought was also a fun conversation from the story, was when they're talking about the art of this particular sculptor at the beginning and sort of docking in points for just being too realistic and not making it something beautiful as well. Do you remember that conversation?
I do. Yes.
Yeah. And I think it's a funny thing. Like, I think there's a lot of beauty in real life, but the artist's, in a certain sense, specific call is to take that and to almost purify it of, you know, and arrange it and to basically make something that is particularly beautiful about it, that can be shared with others.
No, I was just going to say, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about the realism point, but I think that does sort of tie back into him literally, you know, kind of taking the soul out of this woman. And you could say that the soul is also missing in his art. If he's too much of a realist and there's something missing there, maybe that ties somehow into the impulse to Porphyria's lover, your lover.
Yeah. That's interesting. That poem, I hadn't thought about that. So talk to us about that poem again. I remember it a little bit now that you're talking about it, but like, there's like the head in a,
I it's been a long time since I've read it, but the basic for the audience, the basic premise of the poem is the dude's lie next to his lover and strangles her to death because he doesn't want to lose her.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, this guy's got very strong Porphyria's lover energy.
Yes.
But, you know, that's that. I guess that's a little bit of a tangent. I guess my point was that if they're talking about his art, you know, missing something, being excessively realistic, well, it seems like, you know, I think there's maybe there's something there. There's something there with the art is lacking a soul, and then he sucks the soul out of his woman.
Yeah,
he's like a vampire.
yeah. I think there's definitely something to that. I agree.
We have to bring all these podcasts back to vampires because we're trying to tap into the Twilight fans. But
well, I think this would have a certain appeal to that type of group, don't you?
Maybe. I don't know. Anyway. We'll leave Edward Cullen out of this. Good sparkly vampire, not a soul sucking one.
Yeah.
Well, so before we wrap up, can you just tell us a little more about the book? Because you've kind of intrigued me here a little bit.
Mythical Mammals?
Yes, please.
Yeah, well, so Mythical Mammals is a compilation of 26 poems, one for each letter of the alphabet. And the title suggests it's all about mythical mammals, made up mammals that my buddy Matthew Meehan came up with for each of these letters. And then I illustrated, and the poems are just a ton of fun. But he's one of these super nerds, if you will. And I think he would forgive me for using that term.
Mm.
But each one of the poems sort of gets at some aspect of classical literature or, you know, philosophy or humanities or civics. He's into a lot of things, but each one of these poems is sort of like this puzzle that works with the pictures, and that he wants to try and get young readers, as well as young at heart readers who will be reading to the young readers, to help sort of jog their imaginations to start asking more questions about some of these really rich, beautiful subjects that are the heritage of Western civilization, in a certain sense, that he as an academic has been so excited about that he wanted to share, and in fact, make these poems to make it more accessible to modern readers. And I was enlisted to that end, to help make these things accessible, to make them joyful and beautiful, and hopefully to be a treasure for the ages in its own right, and help many generations, particularly to understand friendship and to understand how do we make good friendships? What are the enemies of friendship? What are the aids to friendship? So if you look at the book with those things in mind, you might be able to unlock a lot of the hidden meaning and hidden truths that Dr. Meehan and I hopefully worked hard to bury well, but not too deeply, in those poems and illustrations. So that's my quick sell on the book. Not too quick, but hopefully intriguing enough.
Well, you know, maybe I could buy the book for my kids, and after I read it and you know, if maybe we can have you back on, we can do a more of a discussion of magical mammals. Is that the word, or is it marvelous mammals, or what is it?
Mythical mammals.
I said like literally every other word.
That'd be great. That'd be great, Francisco. I'd love to hear what you think about it, and love to talk to you about it.
Yeah, I mean, we don't normally do kids' books, but I mean, this one sounds like it might be worth doing. As a final note, you know, you are an artist, you sell your art. Is there a place where people can find that?
Absolutely. Please do visit my website at www.johnfolley.com. You can sign up for my email list there, and would love to hear from you. And also, I have a blog, Beauty Advocacy, where I talk about a lot of art nerd stuff. So if you're interested in that, please, you know, sign up for that email list. I'll keep you in touch.
Beauty Advocacy, huh?
Yep.
Who knew beauty needed advocates? But perhaps, well, it does.
It does. It's interesting. One of my favorite quotes, I'll have to get it to you. But basically, who is it? It's just flying from my imagination just now. But anyway, it's basically to the effect that beauty, as much as truth and goodness, needs standing up for now more than ever in our modern times.
Many thanks to the brilliant and talented John Folley for coming on The Brothers F. Check him and his work out at johnfolley.com. That's spelled John, F-O-L-L-E-Y.com. There'll be a link to his website in the show notes, as well as a link to his lovely picture book, Mythical Mammals. As always, thanks for listening to The Brothers F. And if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts.